Well, I tend to think of the Gosling as a poem. The critical opening phrase of this poem will always be the grip, which the hands unite to form a single unit. Slowly and slowly, the club head is led back, pulled into position not by the hands, but by the body, which turns away from the target, shifting weight to the right side without shifting balance. Tempo is everything, perfection unattainable. As the body coils now to the top of the swing, there's a slight hesitation, a little nod to the gods. Now the weight begins shifting back to the left, pulled by the powers inside the earth. It's alive, this swing, a living sculpture, and down through contact, always down, striking the ball crisply, with character. There's only one other acceptable theory about how to hit a golf ball.
Oh, boy. Well, what's the other theory?
Grip it and rip it.
This is the Sports Hub Golf Club on 98.5 The Sports Hub. Now, here's your host, Hardy.
Good morning. Welcome to the Sports Hub Golf Club. My name is Hardy, here with you on this Saturday morning, where it seems like if you're on your way to the course, you're going to be able to get some golf in today. I don't even know weather-wise. I don't even think Sarge has time or temp for us and for a while, if at all, on the weekends.
Not today.
It doesn't feel like it. It doesn't feel like last Saturday. Last Saturday was the day driving in. I'm like, and yesterday. Yesterday was the day. As I went to my kid's school, and I was off from work here on the air live yesterday, right? But did the normal stuff in the morning. My daughter's school had a present day. It's a school play. School play. It's wonderful, right? Got done with the school play. I had to go home and do a bunch of work from the house, from the compound, from the Hardy Sports and Music Laboratory in Roslindale at the compound. I go down into the dungeon. It's much like working here, right? Down into the bunker, only to emerge 4 hours later to go pick up the kids from school. And as I'm walking outside, there is only one acceptable place to be yesterday, and that was a golf course. It was perfect. Two problems with it. Number one, life. You got stuff to do. You got work, you got kids, stuff to do. Number two, Fridays. I don't know who plays golf on Friday. Well, I do know who plays golf on Friday. People who are involved in outings, in corporate events, charity tournaments, golf courses often lend themselves over on Mondays and Fridays to these type of events. And to go out and play, it's damn near impossible. It gets a little easier in New England, I think summertime, when people are heading down the Cape or they're going up north. And things empty out a little bit, but this is that odd time of year where people are still around, and if you're going to have a big golf tournament, if you're going to have a big gathering, you got to do it before people are away for the summer, and mid-late June, you can still get people. So I don't even know if you could get near a golf course yesterday. And a buddy of mine yesterday also said, hey, do you want to play Sunday morning? I'm like, oh, I haven't even been going on. I got to work at 10. I think I'm on the air here at 10 at Sunday morning. He goes, oh, don't worry. I have a 5:18 tee time. Like, what? He goes, yeah, that's the only one they had left. 5:18? I mean, I'm an early riser, and I will get up early for come on.
3:30 wake-up call.
It's like down the street from the house. Okay, conceivably, I could get up at 5. What's that first swing going to be like?
I need an IV or coffee.
What are you talking about? So as much as I would have liked to have been playing yesterday or any other day, just getting out of the course. So if you're going out right now, good luck. Have fun. Wish I were with you. All right, let's get to this. I saw Dan Lifshatz as I'm leaving here, who's a big gambler. Our producer today, the captain, McElroy, he comes into me. He says, well, I'm glad I didn't take your betting advice last weekend. All right. You know what? I sat down and I did my mea culpa, or wrote one. I'm not even sure if I know what that word means. I think it's Latin for I effed up. And I wrote it Sunday during the final round of the U.S. Open, when it was becoming painfully obvious to me what was going to happen as the U.S. Open drew to a close last Sunday night. Because if you were listening at this time, exactly 1 week ago, probably at this moment, at 7:07 Saturday morning, on June 16th, I sat here and said, Dustin Johnson will win the U.S. Open. That is going to happen. Go ahead with your plans for the rest of the day. Don't bother watching. Don't go away from your family or sit yourself in front of a TV on Father's Day last Sunday and ignore the people who want to. If you have things to do for Father's Day, if you know whatever it is, right? Don't bother because Dustin Johnson was going to win the U.S. Open. Had all these all this statistical information to back it up. Nobody had ever blown a four-stroke lead after two rounds of the Open. Anybody who was under par and everybody else was even or over. Nobody had blown that. I mean, one or two times back in like you know the 19-aught somethings, right? Probably when the Open was still being played at Myopia Country Club up in Hamilton, right? It was not an issue. Dustin Johnson had a four-stroke lead after two rounds, and he was going to win it. He was hitting the ball longer and as well as anyone else, and his strength was allowing him to get out of the bad spots at Shinnecock, and he was just going to go ahead and roll. I was wrong. And I tendered my resignation from the position of predicting who will win the U.S. Open. From here on.
Joe, what do you got for us today, pal?
I don't know what that was.
Something like a computer.
I'm not going to go down the road of predicting U.S. Open champions. I'm going to try and extend it toward all majors. But my pick wasn't all that bad. I mean, I was talking about Dustin Johnson. The guy who did finish third. However, I was wrong in that you didn't need to watch anything else that happened last weekend. We only got a couple of chances, or I should say, a couple of opportunities to talk about it afterward. Because I was sitting in here with Zoe, and he doesn't really want to talk about golf ever. But one of the things that you would have missed out on, number one, was Brooks Koepka repeating, which I also said would not happen. Like, who's going to, please, Brooks Koepka is going to win back-to-back U.S. Opens? Like, he's Curtis Strange all of a sudden from 29 years ago, going back-to-back in 89 or 88 and 89? Forget it. And it was all part of my whole theory that we don't have any dominant player right now, which, by the way, still holds true. Unless you like Brooks Koepka to win the British. Oh. No, I'm not doing this. Brooks, I am very happy for Brooks Koepka in that he won another major championship, and we have another multiple major winner among this group of young, talented players. So somebody else could conceivably walk into the British or the PGA in August, and you can say, here's a guy who's got a chance to win it all. Because right now, we don't have enough of those guys. You still want to put Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas at the top of that list. But when Jordan Spieth misses the cut at the U.S. Open, it's hard to consider him a real factor week in and week out, at least right now. He blew up a little bit yesterday, I believe, at the Travelers, but he had a really good first round. But this is the Travelers, right? This is not a tournament that these guys are necessarily out to win. It's a very nice tournament that they put on the week after the Open, and they get a nice turnout there for a variety of reasons. But let's face it, this is not what these guys want to win majors more than anything else. After that, the FedEx Cup, I would imagine, for the $10 million that goes with it. But it's the tournaments that these guys want to win that you look at for their importance and for their medal, right? Who's got the stuff? Who's got the stones? Who can go in, week out? And when you had, up until last week, 11 different winners over the past 11 different majors, it's tough to say you've got a favorite. All right, Brooks Koepka can get himself into the conversation now. Not yet convinced, but man, what a performance down the stretch from Brooks Koepka. And as someone on ESPN wrote, that I think it was Jason Sobel, And it was an interesting point at first. Sobel had written that the U.S. Open used to be the domain of the scrappy guys, the grinders, the ones who could keep it, you know, in between the lines, keep it in the fairway, fairways, greens, not get rattled. Those were the guys who won U.S. Opens, right? Curtis Strange, Tom Kite, okay? a top 10 machine, but didn't win majors. He won a U.S. Open. Corey Pavin, right? Guys you look at and say, man, that guy is just, you know, a zoned in, not a supremely talented guy. He's not going to blow you away with driving distance or his short game skill, but just, you know, a grinder, a guy who grinds out pars and, you know, makes the most of his opportunities. Now you got Brooks Koepka, who is an absolute monster. I mean, this guy's an athlete. Not all golfers are athletes, but Brooks Koepka is an example of an athlete who is, in fact, a golfer. Dustin Johnson. You've seen Dustin Johnson hit the ball. These guys overpower golf courses. And Sobel's point was, well, you used to have guys like this who would win the Open. Now you've got these monsters like Koepka and Dustin Johnson who win U.S. Opens. I'm like, yeah, that's true. Hold on a second. Who would you qualify on tour right now as a quote-unquote perky little grinder? I mean, Jordan Spieth pummels the ball. Ricky Fowler, 5 foot nothing, 100 and nothing, pounds the ball. All of these guys are so strong now, especially the younger guys. They are so fit and pliable, to borrow from Tom Brady. Agile. They're so competent around the greens with everything, and they can get themselves out of trouble because of their strength and because of their technique. I don't know who among today's crop of young players who we're looking at the next batch would qualify as being that Corey Pavin slash Curtis Strange slash Tom Kite type of guy. I mean, Fowler, because he's little? Yeah, but he's stronger than hell. The guy can hit the ball 290. That's what qualifies as a grinder? Someone who can go bomb it 300 yards off the tee? Well, he doesn't hit at 330 like Dustin Johnson. So what? He's still leaving himself 8-iron into most par fours at the most. I don't know who that guy is anymore. I guess if you want to still adhere to Sobel's point and still make sense of it, I would say that the strongest of the strong are the ones who have had success most recently in the last three U.S. Opens. Okay, that I will adhere to. In terms of the other thing that you missed out on, that was Phil Mickelson. And what Phil Mickelson did on Saturday is what we're going to talk about next, because it was fascinating to me. And the reaction to it was fascinating, too. And I want to get your calls on this. And here is the very basic setup. What should have happened to Phil? We all know by now that Phil Mickelson, during the third round of the U.S. Open, let a putt get past him, went by him on the hole. It was going to roll off the green down into the fairway. He was assessed a two-stroke penalty for hitting a ball in motion. The argument was that he did it without question to gain a competitive advantage, which he pretty much admitted to. He said he knew the rule. He was willing to take the two-stroke. But the problem is, Rule 1-2 says if you do that, you are subject to disqualification. Instead, they went to a rule further into the rule book and said, no, he just hit a ball while in motion. That's a two-stroke penalty. That's not what it's meant for. A ball in motion is something that's oscillating, or a ball that you think had stopped, but it starts rolling again. He stopped that thing to keep it from rolling off the green. And somebody posed a question to me last night. I was down at Plain Ridge Park Casino for a little send-off for some winners on the website. They won Dave Matthews tickets or something. We all met up for dinner and to, you know, hang out for a while. And somebody said, what if that putt had gone in? What if Mickelson, in knocking the ball back to the hole, what if that ball had gone in? I started thinking about it. I'm like, huh. At that point, I believe he would have holed out for six. Because that was his sixth stroke coming back. I believe he missed the seventh. He tapped in for eight and then was assessed the two-stroke penalty for a 10. What if he had hit that ball and it rolled in for a six? Not the score any of these guys want, but there were tons of sixes being carded at the U.S. Open last week. Would he still have been assessed just a two-stroke penalty for hitting a ball in motion? Or is that when they bring disqualification into the mix? My point is this, and I'll get your reaction on it here just very briefly in the next segment. My point is this. If he's doing that, and he knew that, and he was acting out of a lot of frustration, and he had essentially given up on that hole, You can't give up on any hole in the U.S. Open. You can't give up on any hole throughout a 72-hole tournament. You can't do that. So if he had given up on that one, he had, in fact, given up, and he should have withdrawn. Finish the round, sure, but then, Phil, withdraw. You obviously gave up. You gave up when you did that. Don't tell me that you were just being savvy and you're going to take the two-stroke penalty, because no one does that. Everybody knows you can't do that. You're doing that to gain a competitive advantage, to keep the ball from rolling off the green and down into the fairway. Disqualification. I don't care. Just withdraw. I don't know how you sit down and DQ Phil Mickelson or any other player and try and get them to admit they were lying about their intent. But the fact is, he had given up, so Phil, officially give up. Walk off the course on Saturday, sign your card, and then tell them, hey, in case you guys didn't see that, obviously, I've pretty much given up on this tournament, so I'm just going to withdraw for the final round. That's what I believe should have happened. But we'll take your calls on this. 617-779-0985. We got a lesson coming up later this morning from Chris Hawley. He is the head coach, I believe. I think that's his title, at Core Golf in Natick. They got a director of instruction and a head coach. I think he's the head coach. They have coaches there. That place is legit. So we're going to get a putting lesson from Chris Hawley coming up a little bit later. And let's see. It'll be Dan talking to us about Phil Mickelson right on the other side. And your calls, 617-779-0985.
Stay tuned for more of the Sports Hub Golf Club. Getting you ready to hit the links. It's the Sports Hub Golf Club with Hardy on 98.5, the Sports Hub.
. 7:24 Saturday morning. Hardy here doing the Sports Hub Golf Club. Sarge in on headlines. The captain is back there, and welcome to call in 617-779-0985. We're going to talk a little bit about Phil Mickelson here. And I believe Dan in Cranston is on the line. See if I can pull Dan up right here. Dan, you're on the Sports Hub Golf Club. What's up?
Morning, Hardy. How you doing?
Excellent. What can I do for you? What do you think? Did you hear the question I posed here, Dan, about Phil and whether or not, A, I believe he should have withdrawn, but B, the other thing is, what if that putt had gone in? Does that change your mind? So go ahead. I'll let you take it.
First of all, that's Bush League 101. You and I both know that.
What he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And second of all, if it was Pat Perez or something, he would have been disqualified at the end of the round on the spot.
Without question.
It was just because of who it was as he got the leniency. So should he have withdrawn? Yeah, but he should have just been disqualified and he shouldn't even have the choice. That's in my mind. It's just, you know, he had a statement, what was it, 4 days later this week, basically saying that he should have been disqualified. So.
Well, here's his apology. I'm glad you brought it up, and thanks for the call, Dan. His apology says, I know this should have come sooner, but it's taken me a few days to calm down. What? Okay, he had to calm down. My anger and frustration got the best of me last weekend. I'm embarrassed and disappointed by my actions. It was clearly not my finest moment, and I'm sorry. After the fact, he had said, I don't mean it disrespectful. If you're taking it that way, that's not on me. Oh, Phil, it's 100% on you. I'm sorry that you're taking it that way. Again, this is a quote. It's certainly not meant that way. Sometimes in these situations, it's just easier to take the two shots and move on. Here's the problem with Phil, okay? That right there in a microcosm, that is the problem with Phil. Sometimes just easier, take two strokes and move on. I'm sorry you're taking it that way. Kind of like insider stock trading. And when you send one of your best friends to federal prison for the tip that he gave you that you used to pay back a gambling debt, yeah, that's just easier. Oh, this is 100% true. Billy Walters, golfer, gambler, businessman, right? In Vegas, and you probably know about this story, but let me just bring it back to you. This all went down about as long as 10 years ago. Billy Walters had a bunch of stock in Dean Foods, and he was also very good friends with a guy who was chairman of the board, I believe, of Dean Foods. Phil Mickelson owed Billy Walters over $1 million from a gambling debt, presumably on the golf course. Billy Walters owns golf. He owns Bally High. He's got used to have an office at Bally High right on the strip in Las Vegas, right? Mickelson loses a bunch of money to him. So, at some point, Phil Mickelson, who doesn't buy individual stock, he's not out there day trading, buys 3,900 shares of Dean Foods in an account under his and his wife's name. Then he buys more stock under the names of his minor children. One day later, Mickelson invested $2.4 million in an additional 196,000 shares of Dean Foods stock. You know what he did after that? Waited for the spinoff from the company to go through, and a day later cashed it out and made himself almost $1 million, which he then gave to Billy Walters to pay back the gambling debt. The problem is, Walters got busted for trading on the inside information and went to prison. What about Phil Mickelson? He decided not to attend the trial. He said he would not testify, and if called to do so, he was going to take the Fifth Amendment. Going to plead the Fifth. Prosecutors said he made nearly $1 million after Walters told him to buy the Dean Food stock in 2012. Mickelson gave the profits to Walters to cover the gambling debts. Securities and Exchange Commission sued him over the stock trades. He had to repay the money. This happened. This is true. This all happened. He was interviewed, and they got reports of dozens of them, hundreds of them. All this stuff that everybody, it's all on the record. And by the way, had it happened just a few months later, I believe in the state of California, he would be in prison. At that time, you could only go like two people down on an inside stock tip and bust them for it. But now, the laws of at the time, it's like, no, you can only pass that to one other person. Anyone else they tell is going to be free and clear. Mickelson totally got away with that. Totally got away. And his buddy sits in federal prison because Mickelson won't come forward and help with any other explanation, because he knows the explanation is going to implicate him to the point where he would be absolute toast in the minds of many. I mean, it's like, oh, what kind of big deal is that, inside stock trading? I don't know. These are rich people problems. I don't have these problems. Ask Martha Stewart how big a deal inside stock trading is. I don't know. Martha Stewart, you know, America's, you know, domestic sweetheart. She sat in federal prison for a while for the very same thing. Let's go to, who is this, Dan? I'm sorry. Dan in Hopkinton, what do you got for us?
Hey, Harry, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, you know, if this hitting the ball in motion issue, had it been anything other than an established, rich, country club white guy, he'd have been DQ'd on the spot. I hate Phil Mickelson. His look, his attitude, his arrogance. You know, his nickname apparently is Fig Jam.
Fig Jam, yeah.
I'm good, just ask me. You know, I can't stand this guy. I forgot about the insider trading issue, but just hitting the ball in the you know, this wasn't some crap tournament in Milwaukee. This is the U.S. Open.
I agree.
He hit a ball in motion because he was absolutely irritated, and he thinks, I'm better than this course. This can't be happening to me. I'm going to go and stop that ball. He should have been D2
right
on the spot, and I think the
right,
PGA
because,
take the hit on this.
And again, and thanks for the call, Dan, because it's just easier. Easier to take the two-stroke penalty. Yeah, like it's easier. Is it really easier, Phil, to take the two-stroke penalty, or is it easier to play the ball and play by the same rules that everyone else does and take your bad score in that hole and move on? It's easier just to use this insider stock trading and buy a bunch of stock under my wife's name, my kid's name, and then sell it the next day for $949,000 profit, but then have to give all that money back to the Security and Exchange Commission and then refuse to testify and tell everybody if you do, you're going to take the Fifth Amendment and blah, blah, blah. Or is it easier just to reach into your pocket and say, oh, I owe you $1 million? No problem. I made that in less than a week on one endorsement deal last year. Okay, here's your $1 million. I see the two as being completely related. If he's saying like, oh, it's just easier to circumvent the rules here, which he really didn't. He did get away with it. He got away with both. He got away with his little knockback there at the U.S. Open. He got away with the insider stock stuff, even though he had to give all the money back. And he'll always be under the microscope now. He's always going to be looked at. And there are guys, to Dan's point, there are plenty of people, and even on the tour, will say Phil's a great guy. And there are things about Phil that I really do like. The fact that he is very generous with the clubhouse attendance. He's very generous with, the quote-unquote little people. You know, guys like me who might ask for something or not even ask for anything. When he's tipping out the clubhouse attendance at the end of tournament, he's good for a grand. You know, even if he doesn't make the cut at a tournament, you know, these guys are going to end up, and they love when Mickelson's playing the tournament because they know that their tips that week are going to be massive, right? At least from him. Signs a lot of autographs, seems to always do the right thing. But there are just as many, if not more, guys on tour who have the same attitude that Dan does. Oh, my God, this guy. This phony, this jive ass. Oh, here he goes. He's going to start telling us about this. He's going to start telling us about how to, you know, beat the stock market. He's going to tell us about all the football betting. He's going to tell us about this. He's going to tell us about that. That guy smiley attitude. It just comes across as phony. Comes across as phony when he says he knew what he was doing. He's just willing to take a two-stroke penalty. And you know damn well he was doing it to gain the competitive advantage. But he also knew, he probably knew enough to know that that puts him under scrutiny for possible disqualification. And he also knows the same thing about the inside stock stuff. I really didn't intend to spend this much time talking about Phil this morning. But when we're talking about the things that you would have, had you taken my advice this time, 1 week ago, and not watched the U.S. Open, you would have missed out on that. And you would have missed out on Brooks Koepka repeating as U.S. Open champion. And you would have missed out on a bunch of guys just getting worked over by that golf course at Shinnecock. Which the USGA, by the way, agreed. A couple of greens got away from them. Zach Johnson said after one of his rounds, he said they lost the golf course. Meaning, it was too fast, it was too dry, and there's nothing they can do now except wait a couple of days, water it, let some of the grass grow, get it back to playing condition. By losing the golf course, he meant it was no longer playable. It was playable for Tommy Fleetwood on Sunday. It was playable for Dustin Johnson for the most part. He only finished three strokes off the winner, Brooks Koepka, and it was certainly playable for Koepka. Tee times, when those guys played during the day, that had a lot to do with it. But for the most part, they lost a couple of greens. They did not lose the entire golf course. And Brooks Koepka certainly didn't lose anything because he repeated as U.S. Open champion. So congratulations. By the way, I'm not making any predictions. I'm not going to do anything like this. But guess who is the favorite to win next year's U.S. Open?
Dustin Johnson.
Thank you very much. But I'm not making any predictions. Mike Sarge-Riley has your headlines here. We'll get our putting lesson from Chris Hawley from Core Golf coming up next.
This is the Sports Hub Golf Club. This is the Sports Hub Golf Club. Now, here's your host, Hardy.
We are back on the practice green at Core Golf, 218 Speen Street in Natick. I'm here with the head coach at Core. His name is Chris Hawley. And Chris, you are the self-proclaimed best putter at Core. Is that right?
It's debatable, but I think so.
Okay. All right. So we're going to tap you for the putting lesson here today, which, once again, if you want to practice any shot in the bag, driver, mid-irons, wedges, and especially when you get into the short game stuff, chipping and putting, you've got a whole separate part of the facility here with a couple of different greens and areas to pitch from, chip from, thick rough, tight fringe, virtually every shot imaginable. But we're going to make it real simple here today. It looks like you've got something set up for the dreaded four-footer.
That I do. This is a good little drill that I like to start off a lot of practice sessions with my students, with myself. And what we have here is I have set up the gate drill. So I've set up two tees right beside the golf ball. So when my putter goes through, there's barely enough room for my putter head. So this is not only working on alignment, but this is working on the path of the putter. So if I hit one of those tees, then the strike on the putter face is going to be off center. So this is a really good drill to just kind of start off with. You start seeing your lines and making sure that you're lined up right at the center of the cup. I see a lot of people who just walk onto a putting green and start whacking 20, 30 footers with not really aiming or any sort of speed or line things in mind. So this is a good way to start.
Now, I hear all kinds of differing opinions on how you should, you know, start your practice putting sessions, especially when you're getting ready to play. But one of the things I've heard is one of the things you just mentioned not to do, and that's just roll some balls without any thought of where they're going, just to get an idea of the speed. I mean, is that an awful idea, or would you not recommend it?
No, so this drill right here is working on line, making sure that you're lined up properly. And then after this, we're going to go into another drill where we focus on speed. So we usually start off with a couple drills, okay, and then we'll kind of mix it up and do some other things where we're
focused. So you're telling me to hold my horses, essentially?
Basically, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, let's see what we've got here. Now, I've seen this being done, like, at the formerly the Deutsche Bank, now the Dell Technologies, but, you know, guys who are in the top 100 in the world setting up little tee gates to work on the path of their putter. Does this promote a straight-back, straight-through putting stroke? Does it matter if you're more along the kind of the arcing putter stroke type of method? What does this help?
I personally believe in more of an arc in the putting stroke, but there are players out there that do believe in the straight back, straight through.
But this, since you've only got two tees set up, creating that very, very narrow gate, it shouldn't matter a whole lot because you're not arcing it back on a 45-degree angle or anything.
Correct. So this is making sure that your putter face is square at impact, which is goal number one in putting.
Now, you've also got an alignment aid lined up. And by the way, you'll be able to see the video of this up on our website and through the app and on Twitter at Hardy985. But you've also got an alignment aid running from one of the tees to the cup. I mean, to me, this seems like an obvious, you're just pointing it there. Is there something more to it than that?
This is just alignment. So when you stand over the putt, it's kind of showing you the line that you want to hit it on. So it's just making sure that your lines are matching your eyes. So when you get over the putt, first four-footer in a competitive round, you feel comfortable and confident that you're lined up at the right target.
Because a lot of times we're just setting the putter up the wrong way. And this gives you an idea as you're standing over this short putt where you can see the hole. You don't have to look clear across the green. You're looking at a four-footer. This is, in its very basic sense, gives you an idea of whether or not you're lining your putter face up correctly.
Absolutely. So this is just making sure the eyes and the body lines are on the same page.
Okay. Well, this seems pretty self-explanatory. You'll be able to see a video of it. Why don't you roll one in the cup for me just to make sure I know that this works and this is not a bunch of nonsense here, Chris. Okay, that works. Come on, you sunk a four-footer with a T-gates and an alignment aid. I don't know how impressed I should be.
Yeah, I actually bring this out at the course every time. So when I play with a few people, I get a little upset at how long it takes me. But
I'm not sure this is all completely legal. Okay, great, you made another one. All right, now let's talk about this speed drill. What are we doing here?
All right, so we're going to move over here. I have three tees set up about 15, 20, and 25 feet away. And I'm actually going to take this alignment stick and move it behind the hole. And you can vary your distances. So I'm going to start off with about 3 feet directly behind the cup. And we have one goal in mind here. We want to reach the front edge of the cup, but keep it short of the alignment stick. Now, this is one of the biggest things that most golfers, you know, even your average golfer, a good golfer, everybody needs to work on. Most people will ram it by 6-7 feet, miss the one coming back. So when we start off with this drill, I'll hit two putts from 15 feet with one goal of mine getting in that zone. So when I make those two putts, I can move back to the next one behind it. And I make those two, I keep moving back. If I miss one, I start all over again.
Ideally, do you want the ball to die at the cup, or on a miss, do you want it to roll a certain amount past?
I mean, it depends what you're looking at. If you're looking at a downhill putt, you don't want to be trying to ram it in. If it's a sharp breaking putt, it's I'm trying to diet in more. But if I'm going a little more uphill and, you know, need to be a little more firm with it, I'm okay with that. But
you're okay with going past the hole on an uphill putt? To me, those are the ones I'd rather leave short, so I leave myself a tiny uphill, I was going to say par safe, bogey safe.
Yeah, well, within reason. We don't want to be ramming it 4, 5, 6 feet by.
Which is why you have the alignment stick back here.
Exactly, okay. Exactly.
All right, so you can take a look at both of these drills on video right now, but why don't you roll one of these putts here for me and tell me what you're thinking about speed-wise. Chris Hawley is the head coach here at Core Golf, because this is, I mean, alignment, a lot can go wrong, a lot can go into your thinking, and we can talk about green reading for an entire show if we wanted to. But since we're focusing on speed here, what should you be thinking about when you're trying to determine the speed of a putt that you're seeing for the first time out on the course?
So right here, I'm just kind of going through my routine. I'm standing about 4 or 5 feet behind the ball, and I'm just trying to figure out what the slope's doing here. So it looks like it's a little side hill and also a little downhill there towards the end. So I'm just trying to get a gauge and feel for the speed. So when I step over it, all I'm thinking about is really just getting lined up and feeling the speed. I'm not too concerned with line right here. This is just 100% speed.
Feeling the speed doesn't help me out, though. What are you going to take the putter back a certain length for a shorter putt? Do you think about how far you're taking it back? Do you think more about the finish position? What should be the thought process when we're trying to figure out how hard to roll this thing?
So on a drill like this, I'm not getting too wrapped up in mechanics whatsoever. So I'm really relaxed with my grip, letting that putter flow, and I'm focusing on the length of my stroke to control that distance. I see a lot of amateurs where they'll take it back really short and then jab at it through it, or vice versa, bring it back really far and then decelerate. So those both are no-nos.
The dreaded decel, but that's what I was looking for. So the length of your stroke going back, but maintaining acceleration through contact.
Absolutely. The length of the stroke is super important.
Again, a lot of talk. Let's see what you can do. That's a pretty good putt right there, Chris. And you left it short of the alignment stick back there.
I'd be pretty happy with that. It had a chance to go in. It was finishing the zone. Didn't go in, but it's an easy two putt.
And once you make a couple from here, then you move back to the next section?
Exactly. And it does get a little harder. This drill may look easy, but I used to use this with the college team that I coached, and we would do this almost every single practice. So it's even very good for the top amateurs or professional golfers.
Again, I've seen guys doing this on the practice green at tournaments before, so this isn't just for people who are trying to get from, ooh, that almost went in, from awful to not so bad, but for very, very good players, this is the type of thing that they work on too. Chris Hawley, head coach at Core Golf in Natick, 218 Speen Street. Check out the video of these drills and more online. Chris, thanks again, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Sports Hub Golf Club on 98.5 The Sports Hub. Now, here's Hardy.
Back to wrap things up here on the Sports Hub Golf Club, and going way, way off the help me out here, Sarge.
What's up?
Beaten path.
There you go, yeah. Way off the, let's see, the golf path.
Way off the cart path.
Yeah.
Thank you.
There you go.
Hand me that Deep Eddy vodka stuff over there, would
there you
please? Because it's time for the, would you hand me, not the bottle. I just mean the paper. It's the 19th hole. It's brought to you by Deep Eddy Vodka. Every week we talk about a different place to grab a drink, after your round, and we call it the 19th hole. Deep Eddy Vodka, authentic American vodka made in the heart of Texas. Deep Eddy Distilling Company, Austin, Texas, 40% alcohol by volume. Please day drink responsibly. And up until this point, it's always been a bar at a golf course, which is the idea. But I'm going off the cart path, so to speak. You ready for this one? You're not going to see this one coming. A lot of nice golf courses down around, say, the Foxborough Plain Ridge area. How about you stop in over at Doug Flutie's there at Plain Ridge Park? I was down there last night. Nice setup down there. And I've been to Plain Ridge before, but I'd never actually been in Flutie's before. Great food in there. Nice bar. Huge TV setup. get yourself a drink there. Get yourself a Deep Eddy vodka there. If you're playing any of the courses around there, I know Chris down in Plainville always asking to come down there. That's a great spot to go. You know what it reminded me of? I'll tell you what it reminded me of, playing golf in Las Vegas. Because that's what happens, at least now when I go back. Not when I lived there so much, but now when you go back, you play golf. And then what do you do after you're done playing golf? You go back to the casino. And for me, sure, you know, the live table games you don't necessarily get, but the video poker's there. Daddy needs his video crack. Get me down in front of a video poker machine with a cold drink after a round of golf. Oh, that is my happy place. So my off-the-cart path choice for the 19th hole this week is Doug Flutie's Sports Bar down there at Plain Ridge Park. There you go. Put that one in the old hopper for next time you gotta round down anywhere in that area. All right, so that'll do it for this week's Sports Hub Golf Club. I want to thank Chris Hawley, our guest there, with the putting lesson there from Core Golf in Natick. Next week on the show, I believe we'll be checking in with Bill McInerney, who is one of the founders over there from Core Golf. Also, our friend Paul Gazbekian. It's time. You know, it was a couple of weeks ago. Caitlin Sharpless was in. She's great, talking about, you know, essentially strength and conditioning. Paul is the original strength and conditioning guy here in the Sports Hub Golf Club. He's a trainer over at Equinox, and he's legit. Paul is just, I mean, such a good guy. And even if you don't follow everything that he says to do, if you follow even just a little bit of it, you're going to be in much better shape, literally and figuratively, to get back on the golf course, which is what I did. I went and saw Paul once I had some major issues to deal with my back. And instead of surgery, I went a different route. And the route I went was to see Paul. And you know, some medical professionals as well, but to get myself back on the course. So, you know, for me, it worked. Not to go all TB12, but what? I can't hear you. Hold on a second. Can we have his mic up, please, Captain? What's that?
Some media members would have gone to see Alex Guerrero.
I'm not endorsing him, and I'm not saying it'll work for you, but it worked for me. That's all I'm saying.
And I tell everybody I know that he's like a wizard and... He will cure whatever problems you may have.
You going after Curran today? Is that the...
I'm not going after anybody. I'm just saying that, you know, some media members would have gone to see Alex Guerrero.
Curran and I are supposed to go play LeBaron Hills here sometime soon. If you start cracking wise about Curran, I'm going to be disinvited. He literally has a list. He showed
I bet his swing's in good shape because I hear he works with a guru.
Curran has a list on his phone. I swear to you. I saw it with my own eyes. List of people... He wants to play golf with.
Oh, right? I thought it was going to be like a list of people that, you know, like...
he's referred to Alex Guerrero?
Like Steve Buscemi's character with the lipstick. And
you know. No. This is... You know how you'll say to somebody, we should play golf sometime. We should play golf sometime. Curran keeps a list on his phone of people who he has said that to, people who he just didn't say to, but really meant. He's like, oh, yeah, which is kind of a good idea. We need a fourth. Who should we call? He's got a list on his phone. Oh, let's call this guy.
So these are just like regular people then? Like this isn't like famous people or anything like that? Like his, you know, these are people that he's always dreamed of playing golf with?
No. Yeah, this is not his ultimate four. Jesus, Arnold Palmer, and Gandhi.
The Dalai Lama.
Yeah, a big hitter. Long. No, I will say there were a couple of quote-unquote famous people on that list, but just people that he knows and has run into, right. And they have had the conversation, we should play sometime, and he's like, oh yeah, I got to remember to call him next time I need somebody, so I made that list.
Hey, we need a fourth. Is Belichick available?
Don't
call.
Don't screw up the list for me, okay? I want to stay
so
on that
you,
list.
So you're on the list?
I'm on the list.
Okay.
He's asked me several times. He does not understand. He's forgotten... He's forgotten what it's like to have young children and be, you know, booked solid on the weekends.
Right. His kids are old enough that he can send them to see Alex Guerrero.
Or they can go out and play with him, you know, and that like they can be a member of the group. It's like I'll play golf with my daughter from time to time, but, you know, to play from the tips at a, you know, course, just
tell
she's not quite ready
to man up.
She's
not
quite. She's not quite ready for it. What? I want her to enjoy the game. It's all about fun. It's just about having fun. Are you going to have any fun today, you and Flynn?
Not at all.
All right.
Not at all.
Are you and I going to have any fun tomorrow morning at 10?
I hope so. Right. I hope you're bringing your fun pants.
But who's going to drive the ship tomorrow? I want to know right now. Who's gonna anchor the program? Tomorrow, Ryan Johnston and I will be on from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m.
Matters not to me, my friend.
No, it does.
Does it?
Yeah.
Why?
Because
does your preparation change?
Yes.
If you're not driving the ship,
yes.
Do you not prepare?
I'm not saying what I will prepare less for, but one of them requires me to prepare less. So you tell me which one you want to do right now.
I really don't care. So I will give you the option.
Okay, good.
Your choice.
You better prepare then. Johnston and Flynn coming up next. Sarge with the Hub Headlines.